Like a backstage pass to the world of fly fishing travel, this is Waypoints, the podcast of destination angling. News and events, helpful travel tips, destination profiles, great stories, and expert advice from some of the most seasoned and experienced names in fishing travel. Waypoints is brought to you by Yellow Dog Fly Fishing Adventures, the industry's number one specialty travel company for the very best insider knowledge, logistical support, and trip preparation. Freshwater or saltwater, international or domestic, Yellow Dog has you covered for your next fishing adventure. And now, your Waypoints host, Yellow Dog founder and director, Jim Klug.
Wild trout populations in Montana's Jefferson Basin, an area that includes the world-famous Big Hole, Ruby, Beaverhead, and Jefferson Rivers, are in severe distress. Legendary for cold water fisheries that have historically supported an abundance of wild trout, the rivers in southwest Montana are currently experiencing what some have described as a collapse in numbers. And recent reports from Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks confirm that wild trout populations in this part of the state have in fact diminished to historic lows. In the Big Hole River, May 2023 trout population surveys released by Montana FWP confirmed that wild trout populations are today as low as 400 to 500 fish per mile, down significantly from the 1,400 to 1,600 fish per mile counts from less than 10 years ago. In the Beaverhead River, trout populations may be down as much as 50% and possibly more. In the Ruby, more than half of the historic brown trout population has simply disappeared. But while doom and gloom scenarios have been dominating Montana media over the past several months, it is important to acknowledge the differing opinions as to how critical this overall situation is. There are anglers, business owners, and other connected stakeholders who have varied thoughts on the current state of these fisheries, as well as different views as to what can and should happen in the foreseeable future to properly manage and restore these fisheries. There is a lot of data and a lot of science that needs to be studied, and so much more that must be determined before anyone simply writes off these fisheries as too far gone to save. The good news is that a lot of people, including decision makers, politicians, fisheries biologists, and outdoor recreation businesses, are now paying attention. Save Wild Trout is an organization that was launched to address this very situation. A coalition of anglers, river advocates, concerned citizens, businesses, guides, and outfitters that have come together with the focused mission of protecting wild trout for the benefit of all. Since the group's recent inception, they've been organizing and pooling resources to immediately investigate southwest Montana's wild trout population issues, while at the same time generating awareness about the factors that directly impact the area's cold water fisheries and healthy rivers. They are looking for solutions to fix the current situation, and while the numbers today may indeed be alarming, there exists a degree of optimism as to the future of these fisheries, if we can agree that a problem exists and if we can work together to fix things. I'm joined today by two founding members of Save Wild Trout, Guy Alsenser and Wade Fellen, two individuals who know a thing or two about the rivers of southwest Montana. Guy is the executive director and founder of Upper Missouri Waterkeeper, an organization dedicated to defending clean water throughout the 25,000 square miles of Montana's Upper Missouri River Basin. A longtime resident of Bozeman, Guy approaches the work of safeguarding water through the perspectives of an attorney, farmer, father, activist, and outdoorsman. Over the years, Guy has built effective campaigns challenging illegal river pollution and corporate polluters. He's worked on the relicensing and regulation of hydroelectric facilities. He's tackled battles on behalf of endangered species and led coalitions on behalf of rivers and wildlife. Guy is joined today by Wade Fellen, a guide, lodge owner, and outfitter on the Big Hole River. Wade is a fifth-generation Montanan whose family has a strong connection to both river recreation and ranching in the Upper Missouri Basin. In the late 1800s, his family pioneered one of the first cattle ranches in southwestern Montana on the headwaters of the Big Hole. And in 1984, his father, Craig Fellen, founded one of the West's first destination fly fishing lodges. Wade is now a co-owner of Big Hole Lodge, where he co-manages operations while continuing to guide the Big Hole and Weiss Rivers throughout the summer season. Wade is a past chair of the Big Hole River Foundation and the co-founder of Save Wild Trout. Guy Alsenser and Wade Fellen, welcome to Waypoints, and thanks for joining us to talk about what is going on with the rivers and the wild fish populations in Southwest Montana. It's good to have you guys here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, great to be here.
This is an important conversation. I'm glad we're getting to do this, and I hope our listeners will take a lot away from this this episode.
Absolutely. A lot to get through today.
Absolutely. Well, gentlemen, let's begin by talking about the Jefferson Basin and the rivers of the area. Now, most anglers and many of our listeners, they know the names of the rivers, right? The Big Hole, Ruby, Beaverhead, and Jefferson. They recognize these rivers for the iconic fisheries that they are. But unless you've been following recent news here in Montana, most of our listeners are probably unaware of what's been happening with these rivers. In a nutshell, tell us what's going on. Wade, let's start with you.
Sure. So I have guided for my father for the last 17 years on the rivers you just mentioned. My dad started the lodge in 1984. He came out here from Pennsylvania and, guided in Aspen. And the fly shop owner in Aspen was the one that convinced my mom from Bozeman, who moved to Aspen for the skiing, and my dad, lodges aren't really a thing in the West right now. You kids ought to go out and start a fishing lodge. And Dad loved this idea. So he drove through the whole, Mecca, the whole Trout Highway through Idaho and Wyoming and Montana and Colorado, and came back to Aspen and said, I found the spot. I found the Mecca. And it's right in the heart of the Big Hole, Beaverhead, on the Wise River, stone's throw from the Ruby and the Jefferson. And, I don't know that they knew back when they started this what the history leading to this moment was. You've got the last river in the lower 48 with fluvial Arctic grayling, river-dwelling grayling. It's an Arctic fish. Then you have West Slope cutthroat and mountain whitefish. Those are the three natives in that river. And then in the early 1900s, we trucked out brook trout and rainbow trout and brown trout. And by 1960s, there was a revolutionary biologist who said, if we stop managing for these fish in particular and start managing for the habitat of these fisheries, they'll succeed on their own. And, the guy had death threats and everyone thought this was insane. You've got to put and take. But this region of Southwest Montana and eventually all of Montana stopped stocking rivers. And, 50 years later, summers are longer, days are hotter. There's more use on the water throughout the valley, and this cold water fishery is suffering some warm weather impacts and changing land use and increased pressure. So it really is a death by a thousand cuts scenario that's led us to this moment that's finally hitting the newspapers. It's not a 2023 problem. This has been going on for the last 10, 15 years, and we've been watching numbers decline in the river over the last seven. And I think the biologists have been behind the scenes working really hard at kind of bringing this forward, and it hasn't hit mainstem. There hasn't been political will behind it to make this a priority like it became in 2023. But we went from 2,000 fish per mile down to 800 fish per mile right by the Wise River, and 500 fish per mile down in the lower Big Hole. We hit near historic lows on the lower Beaverhead below Barrett's Diversion. For those of you familiar with the Beaverhead River, that upper river under the raceway is packed with fish there at a historical average. The Ruby River has been suffering some algae blooms and low water over the years. We've known the fish are probably struggling, but we didn't know they were at historic lows. And then the Jefferson, we've all watched get dewater year over year, so it's really good at times. In the spring and early summer, it's great, and then in the fall, those fish come back in there. Now we know that river is the aggregate of the three sins above, and it's up to us. It's up to us to solve this before it's too late, and unlike elk that have one calf a year, it would take forever to bring a herd back. Fish have thousands, so if we solve the water quality issues within the main stem of each of those rivers, and then continue to allow Fish, Wildlife, and Parks work on replacing the native fisheries habitat up in the mountains and manage for the habitat like Vincent said we ought to way back in the day, I think we bring this right back.
Well, one of the things you mentioned, Wade, and I want to throw this over to Guy for a second. You talked about the wild trout factor. And this is not a conversation that's had in a lot of Western states or a lot of states within the U.S., period. Guy, why is this a uniquely Montanan issue and a major factor in the entire discussion of the state's fisheries? I mean, a lot of our listeners may not understand or realize the wild trout element of Montana's fisheries.
Absolutely. And I think you hit the nail on the head, Jim, going back to this principle of what makes something wild. And I think we trade that term around a lot in the American West. And I think, unlike Wade, I come at this perspective from the natural resource law and land use attorney. I'm a practicing water attorney in Montana. And when we talk about things that are wild, particularly aquatic species, what we're specifically talking about is we're not stocking. We're not doing active intervention. So if you go to the Northeast, where I'm originally from, you have tons and tons of stocking efforts. You have public subsidized government programs that are actively managing those rivers and introducing fish to make sure that you have those good opportunities. And what makes Montana unique is we not only have a wonderful aesthetic, right? These rivers, the communities, they're friendly, they're inviting, they're open, they're relatively untrammeled. But we also have species that have existed here or been introduced in the early 1900s, as Wade said, but they're not managed in an active sense. We're not doing genetic modification. We're not doing big hatchery programs to stock them in there. So when we talk about Southwest Montana having, for example, in the Big Hole or the Beaverhead, 2,000 to 2,500 fish a mile, that's a self-sustaining population. So if you're a businessman, think of it as, boy, that's easy money. That's residual income. It's taking care of itself. That's something that you want to perpetuate on a basic economic principle. But more to the point ecologically, that's something wild and special and worthy of protecting because we don't have anywhere else in the Northern Rockies, much less the American West, that actually has a self-sustaining population. No human hands are on it. You got to go out there on your own merits, throw that fly, and good luck and God bless.
Well, it is unique, and it's certainly something that makes Montana so special. And I think a lot of anglers, whether they live here in the state or travel from all over to visit and fish Montana, realize that it really is in a league of its own for that reason, among others. Wade, I want to call it, you know, recently we talked about the death by a thousand cuts, right? This is not necessarily a new issue that's impacting the Jefferson Basin and the rivers of the area, but it's been a recently accelerated situation with a lot of attention on the severe numbers, the crisis that's unfolding. Now, a number of stakeholders, primarily anglers, guides, outfitters, have come together to start this new coalition called Save Wild Trout. Talk to us about the creation of this effort, why it's different than previous efforts, and why it was needed now.
So it's not a new idea, like the 7-year fisheries number decline. The idea of Save Wild Trout didn't hatch in 2023. This coalition of outfitters, concerned citizens, and local organizations, specifically Upper Missouri Waterkeeper, has called for a cold water fisheries task force, which is the idea that all these agencies that work really hard and have great people on the ground working really hard have, by design, not of their own, stovepiped their data. There's no left hand talking to the right hand. So you've got Department of Environmental Quality with all sorts of good pollutions data. You have the Big Hole River Foundation that picked up where they left off on the Big Hole River in 2009 and has updated the water quality snapshot in 2023. 4 years in a row now, we've updated that snapshot, and they've showed, at several times of the year and in certain areas of the river, three times the nutrient limits set by the Clean Water Act. Then you've got flow people, the DNRC, that are out there saying, you know, all these water rights in Montana are decreed, and, you used to tack at the end of your ranch on a tree how many miner's inches you were going to irrigate with. By the 1960s, they realized there was more water allocated to property rights than existed in the waterways. So they spent the last 60 years re-adjudicating all these basins. Now, DNRC and the ranching community admit this is still an honor system. That there are not measuring devices. There's no way of exactly knowing where that water is going. And moving forward, that's one of the things the ranching community has joined us in calling for is a way of quantifying exactly which water exists where and how it's being used. Now take Fish, Wildlife, and Parks and all their biological data and what they're seeing with the trout that we're seeing physically, you know, cauliflower face, chemical burn looking, dying zombie fish, as they've been termed in the media. Although I like frankenfish, that one's new. It'll get clicks. And then take, you know, USDA and USGS. All these agencies have great data sets. We don't need to be doing a lot of new studies now moving forward. We need to aggregate the data already collected and make management decisions. And we've called on the government to do this through a Cold Water Fisheries Task Force 3 years running. If they're not going to do it, then Save Wild Trout formed to do it, you know, rather than public interest, which not necessarily a criticism, just nature of governmental barges move slowly. And when they try and turn on an about face for an emergency situation like we have now, it's not going to happen quickly. Whereas Save Wild Trout, funded by all of you listeners, you know, we can move pretty quickly and have. We raised quite a bit of money this year in the last 2 months, hired a science team lead. He's putting together a full team of interdisciplinary scientists that can get out in the field and fill in the gaps left by the response from the governor's office and Fish, Wildlife, and Parks as they move forward on their 3 to 5 year plan, which is important too.
Well, and one of the key things is taking that information that exists in all these different organizations, departments, and getting them out of that stovepipe kind of channel.
Right.
That's key. Well, you go to the Save Wild Trout website, which is a great website, by the way. Tons of good information. SaveWildTrout.org. I would encourage our listeners to check it out for sure. You know, the messaging that talks about these collapsing wild trout populations in Southwest Montana, you know, the data, the facts are real. Guys, it's safe to say that any kind of collapse will not only kind of negatively impact the regional economy and the river-based businesses, which we all know, but this also has huge implications for the local communities, future generations. I mean, Montanans' way of life. It's a big deal when we're talking about this kind of collapse.
Absolutely. And when I think about collapse, I think about the rippling effect that we have. And often the business community will think of something in terms of dollars and cents, right? It's important to keep the lights on, got to put bread on the table. But I think it's also important to think long-term about the social implications, which is to say, in Montana, fishing is like godliness. It's our traditions. It's part of our heritage. It's our value system. And at the same time, it's also there's an ecological value that's at stake, right? The idea of having healthy, clean waterways that are resilient, that are going to be able to provide value economically, socially, ecologically for both the wildlife themselves, but also for the utilitarian principle that we enjoy going out in the river. And there's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, I hope more people come to Montana to go fishing. That being said, it's really important to remember that the consequences of a collapse of your one of your keynote species, right, particularly wild trout, this is your canary in the coal mine. And I think that we would it would behoove us to remind ourselves that we ignore these tipping points at our own peril, right? It's going to have dramatic rippling effects. And just as one anecdote, we know that in Southwest Montana, the county seat, over $175 million a year annually from hook and bullet based outdoors endeavors. And, you know, what does that mean? Well, it means that's where one of your primary ways to put bread on the table and keep the lights on. It means that we have a direct economic stake, not just an intrinsic or altruistic stake in making sure we have healthy rivers and healthy fish populations.
And I think when you put those dollar signs, those economic driver factors, the jobs that are linked, and we're going to talk more about that in a minute, but that's where you start really getting the attention of the people in Helena, in the state capital, because everybody from the business side really responds to that. And it is, it's a huge economic driver for the area. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, I think it's an important facet that we should all keep front and center is that in the end, you know, humans need to be able to produce in the sense of we all want to have shelter. We all want to have readily available food. But what are the least impactful ways to do it that preserve our outdoors heritage, that preserve meaningful ways for us to enjoy life and to enjoy its bounty, but without degrading it? And I would argue that doing things such as catch and release fishing are some of the least impactful ways, but also give you some of the greatest benefits personally. It's a spiritual matter for a lot of people. It's being on a river for at least folks like Wade and I can say, you know, that is a spiritual thing, and being able to protect our ability to do that and to make sure that we can share it with others. That's really where we're seeing that diversity of benefits, right? And let's remember that it's dollars and cents, and it's also about protecting these traditions and sharing them with others.
Well, Wade, speaking of that, all right, you're a full-time professional guide and outfitter. It's the family business, has been for a long time. You're a lodge owner. your livelihood depends on people coming to the Big Hole Valley, the Big Hole River, Weiss River, paying good money to chase big trout. It would be so easy for you and for other guides to kind of deny this crisis situation and simply bury your head in the sand and say, oh, it's really not that big a deal. Everything's fine. Keep coming, keep fishing. You know, I would even point out that by calling attention to the situation like you have been, you're hurting yourself and your business in a short-term way. But talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, no doubt. But if we bury our head in the sand, we guarantee that these rivers are going to go away. And right now we have a real opportunity with some great collaboration within the Big Hole Valley. And a lot of the Big Hole ranchers are also Beaverhead and Ruby ranchers, just by virtue of how cold the winters get up there. This community of Southwest Montana is still small enough that you can come to a table, have a handshake, and get something done. And at this stage, it's not too late. And I think our clientele, and I feel for the fly shops. I think this summer the media has crushed them. I think tourism is down in Montana because COVID restrictions have opened, and a lot of people, you know, you see it in the KOAs up in Glacier Park down to, I don't know if you're seeing it in Bozeman. Bozeman may be a different animal, but walk-in traffic in Wise River, Montana is not what it was last year. And whether that's a factor of just this media this summer or an aggregate of the last 7 years of dealing with hoot owl measures, closures at 2 p.m., low water, people have noticed the fish have dropped from 2,000 down to 800 in those upper reaches and 500 in those lower reaches. I mean, we're hiding the ball from the clientele is not the answer. Most people that, you know, we take 8 clients a week, the people that stay there 6 nights and 5 days, they're not underachievers. They're at a stage in their life where they've solved a lot of problems within their businesses, and they're in a position they want to help. I had a conversation in the parking lot with 2 people this morning that are recently retired. They want to come up here next summer. And what water quality work can we do? Where do we need to be in the water with dissolved oxygen sensors? How can we help? We'll write a check for sure, but how can we get involved? We're, you know, hobby farmers in Ohio now, and this is an ag community issue, and people seem afraid to point fingers at the ag community. Well, let's not point fingers at the ag community. Let's bring them to the table and figure out what soil science is being done, what data sets are stovepiped within that community too, that the fishing community ought to know about. And in the same token, what is the fishing community doing that they can be doing better? We're seeing these lesions on these fish. There's a leading theory right now that nutrient pollution, low flow, and warm temperatures are causing a water quality condition, making these fish susceptible to things like saprolegnial fungus, PKD, a kidney disease. Whirling disease never went away. It's rearing its head in the muds. So the leading theory is this is a water quality condition that is fixable. We need to manage water better, and we need to figure out what we're putting in that water. And if we can get all hands on deck to help solve this, in the meantime, what can the angling community be doing better? If pulling the fish out of the water when their mucus has been removed by a higher pH value within the water column, maybe it needs to be a restriction altogether for the next 3 years that you don't take fish out of the water. Get a GoPro, get your grip and grin under the water. Big fish too. Leave them underwater, get your grip and grin. But for the next 3 years, I think we all need to be open. The ranching community, the development community, and definitely the angling community need to be open to all theories and do whatever necessary. Close the river for spawning, barbless hooks mandatory in fly shops. Don't take fish out of the water and use those little no hook 'em, no touch 'em unhooking release devices and get through this together, and then we'll bring this back.
Yeah. And I guess that's important to note is that there is a sense of hope, but, you know, anglers are aware that Montana's rivers, you know, have suffered really over the past decade, probably longer, from things like low flows, high water temps, variable snowpacks, of course, that, you know, determine all of that, late season fishing closures. There are noxious algae blooms in a number of our rivers. And of course, on a lot of the rivers around here, there's some serious angling pressure, right? And all of these things have combined to kind of get us to where we are today, especially in certain basins like the Jefferson Basin. I mean, what is it that all of a sudden the sense is that we're kind of in crisis mode? And I guess to follow up to your point right there, Wade, is, you know, have we crossed a threshold? Are we now, in full on recovery and rebuild mode, or can we still kind of bring things back from the brink and formulate a plan, an effective, realistic plan to get things back on track and get things healthy?
Well, let me jump in just quickly, Guy. I think if Fish, Wildlife, and Parks had not come forward in May of this year with this transparent data and kind of hat in hand saying, we know flow and temp are drivers of this crash, they called it a crash at that time, on these three rivers that form the Jefferson, which we've known has been suffering for a long time. Had they not come forward at that May meeting, I don't think we would have put the foot all the way to the floor on Save Wild Trout. But the fact that they did seemed like a collaborative call for this is all hands on deck and we need help. We need help from the state agencies. We need help from you anglers to identify what you're seeing in the river. We need help from, 80% of the ranching community is doing the right thing. 80% of the fishing community is doing the right thing. These 20% of bad actors are hampering, whether it's Facebook posts that are just incendiary or literal, misuse of water rights and fishing after the bell and hoot owl. There are things that can be solved that we now know we have to solve quickly. So if we bury our head in the sands and call this a non-issue, I don't think we would have known it was an issue had they not said this spring, because guides are good at catching fish. Anglers are good at catching fish DIY. You're selling the right flies upstairs and we know where the fish are. So there are enough per mile right now. And because there are so few, they're big. The ones that are healthy and fighting off these diseases are gorgeous fish. And then they don't shock for the young of year trout early in the spring. So as the summer's gone on, we've found more of those younger trout. It's a call to action. We have to keep them alive and get them to a spawning age and bring them back. And we do that by solving the water quality issue within the water column.
And expounding on what Wade just put forward there and getting back to your original point, Jim, I think one of the big scientific questions that maybe the layperson doesn't understand is, what is this life cycle of a wild trout, right? How long do we have, or can we essentially, how much flexibility do we have before we're at crisis stage versus we ought to do something, but I'm not, right? It's like, how many times does my wife say, I want that kitchen clean, and I have not cleaned the dishes yet? She tells me many, 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 many times, and I know that there's going to become a crisis level. Well, I'm telling you, I got to do my job, and likewise, I think the onus is on us right now that we are getting all the scientific, empirical evidence telling us we're at the tipping point, right? This is not, the Southwest Montana's rivers are not dead. And likewise, the fisheries are not gone. What we have is a unique opportunity for the next several years to really put the pedal to the metal and to develop interdisciplinary scientific solutions and to think outside the box in terms of management. Wade has already brought up this idea of we have stovepipe governmental agencies that have traditionally not had to work together. We've never had the threats. We've never had the multitude and the urgency of threats. And let's be real specific. My scientific, I don't have a PhD, but I've read the science articles. Essentially, you got 3 or 4 years is how you think in terms of a fishery recruitment, right? So you got your young a year that come out, your eggs hatch. And what we're really looking for is every 3 years, what's that cycle? What's the trend? And if we're seeing persistently declines in terms of the fish recruitment, as we have, that's a cause for concern, because when you also throw into the mix the idea that we have the zombie fish or the frankenfish, these are the fish that are your spawning age that are starting to die. They're not as fecund. They're not having the viability. And this is when we start to see the fish per mile drops. And when we start to drop to a 25th percentile, which is what FWP's data has suggested that they disclosed to the public in May, that's when we're at this point where we need to do that big gut check, and we need to think critically about, are the existing systems serving us? If they're not, what needs to be tweaked? And likewise, where are the gaps in terms of information to make a new informed decision coming at it from a holistic perspective of river management? And again, as someone that works in the legal field of natural resources management, a lot of my thinking is, well, we in fact have completely disparate regulatory systems that fundamentally do not overlap at all, that you don't even have attorneys in the different fields talking to each other, much less the experts. So there really is a critical opportunity, and I would offer a positive opportunity that this is not a done deal. These rivers are not dead. And likewise, wild trout in Southwest Montana have a fighting chance to come back in all their former glory. But this is also a great inflection point for us socially in Southwest Montana to think about, how do we do business better? How do we as a community, as a state that is large but also small in terms of population, come up with a Montana-made solution using empirical nonpartisan science and say, we value these rivers, we value these fisheries, and we value their values in every sense of the word. Let's come up with different ways of doing business that's healthier, and it's going to make them more resilient for now and for future generations.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Wade, you touched on this a moment ago about how it seemed with a lot of the state agencies that things were moving very slowly initially. And initially, the message that Save Wild Trout put out was that the state regulatory agencies, including FWP, Department of Natural Resources and Conservation, DEQ, they had no resources allocated nor really any kind of game plan developed to investigate this basin-wide trout population crash, to identify key causes or to develop solutions necessary to restore these fisheries, to take the right steps. Well, you guys, it seemed like in May and June and really over the last few months, have turned up the heat significantly. I mean, it's been in the news up here. A lot of people are paying attention. This issue is kind of all over the place in Montana right now, and certainly throughout larger fly fishing circles outside of Montana. Are you guys now encouraged by the progress that you've seen over the last few months highlighting the situation? Are we on the right track with the collaboration that has started with FWP in the state?
This is a top priority for them. Out of the governor's mouth last week in Wise River, Montana, he came down, met with, we were under the impression it was going to be a closed meeting. It ended up being a room full of very concerned people, which was great to see. I saw a lot of faces that we haven't seen at the table on the monthly watershed meetings. And that was really good to see. What we learned there is the governor has directed the newly appointed director of FWP and given him a war chest of money. So that's great that this is now being called a top priority, and there's not a quote-unquote staffing and resources issue at FWP. We're not yet seeing that on the ground. Fish, Wildlife, and Parks staff can't just leave what they've been working on for the last 3, 5, 10 years and jump on this issue as quickly as something like Save Wild Trout can.
Let's also make a fine point of that, Wade. When we're talking about a fisheries biologist in Montana, in the Big Hole, they're responsible for a river that's over 150 miles long. Beaverhead, over 120 miles long. And that's one fella. And they may have a couple of different staff members, but I want to make sure that the lay listenership here fundamentally understands these are vast stretches of river. These are not a 20-mile stretch with three tributaries. We're talking about sections that differ in terms of their hydrology, their geology, their tributaries. And likewise, FWP in Montana has had very different priorities. They've been working on headwater creeks in terms of protecting a lot of our different trout species. And that's a fundamentally different project than evaluating and monitoring what's going on with mainstem habitat, which usually has the largest carrying capacity for keeping your trout numbers high. Okay, Wade, back to you.
Well, no, it's a great point. The Big Hole is the mainstem Big Hole is where these browns, rainbows, whitefish, and you know, that's the fish you're catching on a guide trip or out wading in the river by yourself. Because the state has made a priority over the last decade to restore native trout populations up in the feeder creeks. So our one staffer, our one biologist for that basin is up in the mountains and unable to answer the phone when you catch one of these live but sick fish. They're working on that. They've hired somebody to take his place so he can come back down to the mainstem river. But with the $100 million available to Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, we would have liked to see a much swifter, you know, back in May and June response to this with more boots on the ground. What they did do is ratchet down what they could control, which is fishing restrictions, no more treble hooks, no more bait, no more keeping fish. What did that immediately do is it alienated the entire community that goes up on the weekends with their kids and catches a few fish for the for breakfast. And, you know, two of my guides have had their lug nuts loosened at the boat ramps, and two other guides I've heard of had their gas tanks drilled out while they were out on the river. So we're infighting when we should all be coming together and working on this issue. And with a little bit more direction from the state in terms of better enforcement, because all those rules that went in place are not being enforced. Just like there's one biologist for that entire river, there's one game warden. I haven't been checked in 5 years. We're pushing for a barbless hook only requirement like they have in Idaho, which has worked very well. You run your hook, the game warden comes down, runs your hook through Velcro, and if it catches the Velcro, you get a fine. You know, you'll start pinching barbs, and I think that's good and necessary. But we don't have the necessary enforcement. We don't have the necessary staff around these biologists who are doing great work. We need an interdisciplinary task force of experts that work on these issues at the table on a weekly basis, identifying the knowledge gaps and bringing forward to the governor a fisheries management plan for the next 10 years, rather than continuing to react to these problems when they arise.
Yep. Put a finer point on that as well, and going back to the original thrust of the question, I think that one of the biggest resource constraints is back to Wade's analogy of how quickly does the government barge turn when there's a crisis or you got to avoid something coming ahead. It turns very, very slowly. So I think that, Jim, to your point, we've had great success in terms of people taking note that there is, in fact, evidence showing we are at an inflection point. It's an ecologically significant inflection point about population data. No one's disputing that. What it really comes down to now is how quickly can we think outside the box and how do we allocate those necessary resources? And likewise, is it reasonable, thinking as it from a very pragmatic perspective, to think that the government's going to be able to do everything? I would argue, no, it's not. And they're not going to be able to hire someone quickly enough, have the institutional knowledge, and likewise be able to have the protocols to go out and do, you know, very disparate tasks. The idea of doing a protocol to catch the frankenfish that has the sores. I mean, you're still going out there trying to angle for a fish and you don't even know which one is sick. So it's a big task itself. But on top of that, having the protocols and frankly, the human resources out there to actually catch and then send the tissue samples. You know, these are things that don't happen overnight in the best of circumstances. So when you go back to and say, is there a resource constraint? I am personally gratified that we have heard our state leaders, the governor all the way down to Director Temple at FWP, they've said, we have financing, right? We have the finances to get some of this done. But they've also said their scope of inquiry is going to be focusing on the pathology of what are these diseases, and likewise focusing on why are we not having recruitment of young a year, or what appears to be a depressed recruitment issue. What they have not said they're going to focus on, and I'm not surprised, is this idea of habitat and quality of water. And if you think about the basic building blocks of what makes a healthy river system, I feel like we're going back to elementary school. It comes back to this idea of how do you have good water quality? How do you make sure that it's your chemistry, your biology, and your physical, right? So these are the three legs of the stool for a healthy river system. And wild trout, as your canary in the coal mine, they need all three at the top levels. So that's where we're at today. And hopefully we can fill in the gaps in at least one or two other legs of the stool, because FWP say it's going to work on one. And frankly, tackling the disease pathology is a big, big point. And it's a near-term point.
All right. Well, we've got more to talk about. We're going to be right back after a quick word from our sponsors. We've got more from Save Wild Trout's Guy and Wade. For nearly 25 years, Yellow Dog Fly Fishing has worked hard to ensure our clients have every available resource for successful and unforgettable angling adventures. The missing link with the company's resources in the past, however, was the ability to offer complete solutions for sourcing equipment, apparel, and destination-specific fly offerings. Until now. The all-new Yellow Dog website and e-com platform offers anglers a fully stocked fly shop with the most current and relevant brands on the market. The site also pairs the sourcing of flies and equipment with detailed informational resources for more than 250 destinations throughout the world. Traveling anglers now have the most extensive resource available anywhere to learn, explore, and prepare for adventures close to home or halfway around the world. Visit the new website at yellowdogflyfishing.com and let's make your next adventure great. This is Jim Klug, host of the Waypoints podcast. Experienced travelers know that gear and equipment selection is everything, especially when you're headed to remote and distant destinations. For more than 20 years, the team at Fish Pond USA has been setting the standard when it comes to luggage design for the traveling angler, with craftsmanship that incorporates sustainable fabrics and functionality derived from decades of experience. When I'm traveling the world or scouting new destinations, I'm traveling with Fishpond gear. From waterproof duffels to chest packs to all sorts of accessories that make me more effective in the field and on the water. When you take the road less traveled, make sure you're traveling with the very best luggage and accessories. Visit fishpondusa.com to learn more. We're back with Wade Fellen and Guy Allsenser from Save Wild Trout. And gentlemen, I want to take a moment to talk a little bit about Governor Gianforte, what's going on up at the state capitol in Helena. You brought it up earlier, Wade. For several years, there's been a big push to get Governor Gianforte to form a cold water fisheries task force. Nothing has really happened until his recent attention on this issue. Are we encouraged by the near future possibilities of seeing like this something together come together? How seriously do you think the governor is taking this, and what does the path forward look like through Helena?
I'm hopeful. That meeting in Wise River, I had an opportunity to shake hands, look the man in the eye, and understand I was talking to another fisherman, another lover of the outdoors in Montana. And, you know, we can go back to how we got here all we want, and it's been mismanagement for decades, if you want to dive into it. But moving forward now, we are at this moment. He has directed the director of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks to work on all this, and in response to an interagency task force has said, Director Temple, don't you have access to all of that data? So essentially, you know, I read that as you've got the money, you have access to the data, create the task force. So while we haven't seen it yet, you can bet Save Wild Trout is going to be hot on the heels and making sure that that is followed through on. We, you know, we're kind of getting out of the window this summer on a lot of what we can accomplish. The nights are getting longer, thank goodness. It rained for the last 8 days. Rivers have come up a bit. The algae is starting to break loose, which is a concern, because as it breaks loose and dies is when it takes oxygen out of the water column. So Save Wild Trout is actually going to be out there monitoring this and seeing how this might affect macroinvertebrates and our fisheries further this summer. But this winter is when we'll all have time to get off the rivers, out of the fields, come together, and work with the state on whatever they're going to call it. We've asked for a cold water fisheries task force. Doesn't look like that's going to happen. This is a Fish, Wildlife, and Parks led effort. And they've said in their public messaging, they're working with Save Wild Trout and other organizations to bring forward a plan. And they're going to start a 3-year study in March of 2024 on angler caused mortality and start looking into this disease. And they're going to do their thing. And we're asking for collaborative transparency so that we can do our thing, wrap that data up in a bow, and bring it to the table to help inform their management decisions.
Well, and the heat has been turned up over the last few months, there's no doubt. How do we, you know, kind of keep that pressure on the governor, FWP, Helena, getting them to acknowledge the value, the continued value of the state's cold water fisheries, but also the importance of fishing businesses to our state, all the jobs, the economic drivers, all of those things. How do we maintain that pressure so these guys don't just kind of tell anglers what they want to hear right now and then say, oh, yeah, but it's going to take years, be patient, and then, you know, it languishes and nothing happens. What are your thoughts on that, Guy?
Well, some of the easiest things to do, of course, would be to bury your head in the sand and say there's no problem until your business shuts down. And, you know, I'm not here to tell the business community what they have to do, but I would say it's in everyone's best interest in Montana to have a healthy river system that can support our trophy wild trout streams. That's going to bring lots of foot traffic. It's going to bring lots of bookings, and it's going to bring a lot of opportunity to invest in Montana in terms of this state being a model example of not just protecting a world-class wild trout fishery, but also investment in terms of making us a community-based state that has not only a friendly handshake and somebody willing to meet you at the door, but phenomenal experiences that you carry with you for a lifetime and that you can invest in. So I would offer that what can Save Wild Trout do? Boy, we really need to be championing the importance of not only economics, that there's a big economic stake in protecting healthy rivers that support wild trout fisheries, but we also need to be elevating local voices in terms of the people that are the right messengers. I think that increasingly people are concerned about the longevity of their businesses. And as we see big economic shifts, you know, the pandemic was a big part of that with people being able to work remote. And we've had certainly a huge gig economy, a lot of people doing side hustles. I think it's really important for us to understand where do we get our bread and butter these days in Montana and what's going to be sustainable when we look out 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, coming back to it from that ecological perspective. It's a lot less impactful in our environment to be talking about a sustainable fishery and river-based recreation that has the de minimis impact as compared to traditional natural resource extraction with brand new strip mines or what have you. I would offer that, you know, the golden goose of Montana that can keep on giving is probably going to be heavily invested in a clean and healthy outdoors, and businesses that exist today, as well as people that are heavily invested in them. We need to wake up and we need to be coherent in saying we all not only are going to benefit economically if we can solve these problems, but likewise, this is the gift and the legacy that we can leave to the next generation and share with the rest of the country, much less the world, if we can solve it now. So why don't we come together, right? What an opportunity to actually get stuff done and to do it in a measurable fashion.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, Governor Gianforte in the legislature, they need, you know, they are very pro-business. That's their big talking point on all levels at all times. Well, great. Let's have that conversation. I mean, outdoor recreation is the second largest, you know, industry in the state of Montana. The outdoor economy generates $7.1 billion in economic activity for our state every year. It supports more than 70,000 jobs. You were talking about Beaverhead County alone. That's $170 million every year into Beaverhead County, 1,400 jobs. I mean, these are real numbers. And you know, a pro-business governor needs to be paying attention. If he's going to look at it through this lens and that solves the problem, then great. That's fine. He can, you know, take that path to get there. But we've got to, you know, keep that pressure on and keep pushing him to keep this at the forefront. There's no doubt about it.
And I think they need to hear, they being the governor's office and Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, need to hear from all of you listening to this today, because I think too often in Montana, our legislature gets together every 2 years and we think that Montana can solve this internally. And this is not, you know, a resources or problem that we need to sound the alarm about. We should bury our heads in the sand. And then in the winter, when we all have time, we're going to figure it out and work on it. That clearly hasn't worked to this point. So I think now they need to hear from you as we turn up the pressure here locally and let them know how important this is to you. I have clients that are going to come back next year, whether they catch a fish or not, because they've worked their entire life for the opportunity to come dip their toes in the Big Hole River, watch an eagle fly over, and relax and reflect. And if that opportunity goes away, because people go out of business, you know, they may still come back here and rent an inner tube and go do that and you know, risk the otters. But
that's a whole nother podcast.
They really need to know. I have a 91-year-old client that just sent a fabulous check to help us continue our work this year. He can't come back and fish, but knowing that the Big Hole, Beaverhead, and Ruby Rivers will succeed after he's gone and he can be a part of that, that's what the governor needs to hear right now.
Absolutely. And whether you're a Montanan or an out-of-state angler that just loves a trip to Montana or someday hopes to come to Montana and experience all that the state has to offer, it's important to weigh in on that, because they will listen. And, you know, on that note, when it comes to our state legislature and what's going on in Helena, I mean, shockingly, there's been a little buzz lately that some elected officials are saying, oh, diminished fish numbers, crashing populations, we can solve this. Why don't we just stock these rivers? What's the big deal? All the other Western states do it. Are you hearing any kind of accelerated buzz in Helena, or is that something that is just a fringe position? Hopefully so, but I mean, that seems like an insane idea.
Well, it is insane, and it's kind of already happening in our mountain creeks and streams. You know, they put a couple hundred thousand grayling eggs in the Wise River, and they've restored by poisoning out brook trout in much of the feeder streams in the upper Big Hole Valley to restore cutthroat and grayling areas. That's not stocking, but it's close. It's more meddling than they've ever done before with when you ask, is this a brown trout issue down in the main stem, which the media has kind of called it? No, we're seeing sick rainbows. We're seeing a lot of sick whitefish. When you ask FWP, what's this doing to the cutthroat and the grayling? They don't have enough population data on those two species within the main stem river to call that a population. because they're thriving so well in the feeder creeks within the basin because of management. So I would argue that no, we're not stocking these rivers, but the way in which we're managing those populations to keep them off the Endangered Species Act, without somebody filling that void down on these mainstem rivers, has arrived us at this moment.
Yeah, well, an interesting conversation, and could spiral out of control if the wrong people are making the decisions. No doubt about it. Well, Guy, let me ask you this. the game plan moving forward, right? What are the metrics of success that you guys are going to be looking at in addressing this current situation in the months and years ahead? Is there, you know, kind of simply put, what does that game plan look like? What are those metrics?
I think it's really important to think of both near-term and long-term actions. And likewise, to remember that we're confronted with two distinct problems that overlap. We have a disease issue, whether it's existing known diseases that are all happening at the same time, plus another unknown or a brand new unknown, that's not yet currently defined. So there is an immediate pressing need to clearly delineate what kind of disease or diseases, plural, are confronting and ravaging Southwest Montana's populations. And that's particularly acute in terms of the timeliness and urgency, because this is attacking our spawning population. And because we're saying, although we are seeing recruitment, our numbers are so low, right? We're at that 25th percentile, which is that magic threshold that FWP looks at in terms of when you're at 25th percentile of historic numbers, that's where we got to be really concerned, because it could drop off real quick, right? The other thing to think about is also the idea of what are we going to do about managing for what produces the best trout populations, and that always comes down to habitat. If you look at the number one reason nationally for both terrestrial and aquatic species, why species die or get on the endangered species list, it is overwhelmingly due to habitat degradation. And when I say habitat degradation, it means the natural conditions that help support those populations in their ideal state, those are becoming increasingly transformed, degraded, or diminished. And when you think about Montana, and those of you that have been here, we are not New York City, right? We do not have the skyscrapers, what have you, in this part of the world. But our river systems are bit by bit. And I think your earlier analogy, Jim, was very apt, death by a thousand cuts. Are we at a point where we are starting to transform some of the critical metrics that are carrying capacity metrics enough that you can no longer support these species? And I would argue that's exactly what we need to determine with empirical evidence. And so game plan moving forward, near term, we need to build out a current best available model of the Jefferson Basin. What are the water quality conditions for the actual time of year that's most critical, which is essentially coming June all the way through October? We need to fundamentally understand what the heck the water chemistry is like, right? That's one of the three legs of the stool, your water chemistry. Another leg of the stool is your biology in terms of the fishery population. FWP has said it's going to look at that. Great. Well, what's the other piece? Habitat. What's happening with our habitat? And right now, nobody has an up-to-date model in terms of the entirety of these river systems, much less the Jefferson Basin as a whole, identifying where's our essential fish habitat. And likewise, what are our rules or our codes in terms of our agencies that prioritize protection? Think of it in terms of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Isn't it pretty easy if we all had our different agencies to the extent that we got to have government? Shouldn't it be coherently working on the same problem and using all the tools in its tool belt? I would say, yeah. And that's one of the opportunities when it comes to habitat. Let's identify our core essential fish habitat. Let's make sure that we evaluate and quantify. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it in between? And then likewise, what are the strategies, both near term and long term, that we can implement to improve both the water quality as well as the habitat, so that we can bolster fish viability for the next couple of years? And if, you know, again, we have a lot of optimism, Wade and I, and I would offer, if we do that strategy, and you also have a strategy on pathology and recruitment from FWP, that's going to make up the totality of how do we measure both success as well as obstacles, and we're going to be able to get to the next step. So ideally, let's start building out the water quality data. Let's start identifying what does it make for essential fish habitat in the main stem. Where are the problems? And then likewise, what are the solutions, both near-term and long-term?
Well, yeah, and in order to make all this happen, in order to bring it all together, it is going to take a very broad and diverse coalition, especially when it comes to the stakeholders. And often, you know, these might be stakeholders that don't normally share common ground. you know, we talked about the guides, outfitters, the fly fishing businesses, the outdoor recreation entities. You know, those are kind of common bedfellows right there. But let's talk about the ranchers, the ag community specifically. You touched on that earlier, Wade. You know, this August 2nd meeting that happened in Weiss River, you had a lot of the ranchers show up. What was your takeaway on kind of where they stand on this and their willingness to, A, recognize the problem and B, you know, be involved in fixing it?
Yeah, so my dad came out here from Pennsylvania. My mom is out of the Peterson family up in the Upper Big Hole. You know, they came here from Sweden in the late 1800s and started a cattle ranch. So I've grown up very familiar with that community and that passion for wide open spaces. There's a lot of conservation work that is done on those big swaths of land. In the Upper River, if they didn't flood irrigate in the spring, we wouldn't have this flow in the fall, definitely by midsummer. But there are some interesting ideas coming up now, some from the ranching community, some from you know, people we've never heard from before. But if there's all this money on the table and we're in an emergency situation right now, grass is water. So you flood in the spring for the first cut, bring up all this beautiful grass, get your first cut. Some ranchers go for a second cut out of necessity, and they own the water right. They hold all the cards. I would argue that currently, you know, it's a house of cards, and it's getting windy. So we need to help, because cows not condos is a mantra that I think we all share. And if you stick a bunch of straws in that Upper Big Hole Valley, Upper Ruby Valley, Upper Beaverhead Valley, further than you've already seen, we're going to lose the hydrological connectedness of that ecosystem. But how do we keep that water clean, and how do we keep it more efficient? And right now, I think everything's on the table. And one of the leading olive branches that I see is, if you're going to go for a second cut when it's 95 degrees, 30 mile an hour winds, we're all scraping boats down the river trying to find that last pool supporting fish, the fly fishing community ought to volunteer to get off the river at those flows and water temperatures, 68 degree water temps, reel up and go in. But then the ranching community, I think, should accept emergency hay. If we go out and find funding for and buy hay for the second cut and make up whatever you would need to get through the winter and leave that second cut water in the river, don't spray it in the air where it evaporates away, then we help all these studies for the next 3 to 5 years. I think the ranching community is calling for gauges and measuring devices on their ditches and sprinklers. That's huge. There are some studies that can be done, I think, on soil science in the near term to see which fields are at capacity for nutrients already and don't need more manure applied. Conifer encroachment keeps coming up. I think we need to look into how much water a pine tree holds, because I hear arguing theories that they're sucking up all our water, and then I hear other theories that they're actually holding the water and releasing it when it gets cold. So those are some near-term things that the studies have already been done on, I'm sure, and we just need to aggregate them to this cold water fisheries table.
Right. And at the same time, I think it's important for the lay public to understand why we focus so much on this idea of who the ag community is in Montana generally, and the water that they have this right. If you're not in the American West, it may seem very foreign to you. And I just want to take a quick point to lay out. We operate under what's called the prior appropriation system of law, and essentially private property rights are in fact water rights. So you can purchase them, you can sell them, they're an actual commodity and just the same as a house. And long story short, you can't divest anybody of their property right. You know, the United States Constitution guarantees you due process and there shall be no takings. So I want to remind the public that we can talk hot rhetoric all we want about saying we'll just keep the water in the river, but it's not that simple. We are a system of laws. This is a democratic republic, and it's important to remember that we got to work for solutions that are durable through the system, and that hot rhetoric's not going to behoove anyone or help anyone, least of all the fish right now. And I think that, you know, everyone's trying to figure out how do we be a good steward, but the unfortunate reality is the prior appropriation system of law was developed 100 years plus ago, and it had no idea of protecting wild trout. So we got to make do with the system that we have right now. And to the extent you try to buck the system, I think we're going to waste a lot of frivolous resources right now. I think more importantly, we need to be thinking smarter. We need to be thinking about efficiency. If you think about nationally across the United States, all the different water issues that we have right now, it always has come down to say, well, a lot of our infrastructure or the ways in which we do business are outdated, 50, 60, 80 years. I would offer one of the biggest opportunities in Southwest Montana is to look at particular sectors that are heavily invested in how we use the water that is also necessary for protecting and viability of wild trout. And we need to come up with clear metrics about how do we do business in the most efficient way possible that gets you bang for your buck for all the different stakeholders.
Yeah, that's a big deal. And I think a lot of listeners that maybe didn't grow up in the West or grew up in proximity to ag communities don't realize what a big deal those water rights are. You know, there's the famous quote that you hear a lot in the West that whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting. And
it's the truth.
It's the truth today as it always was, no doubt about it. Well, what do you guys say to that small segment of people, maybe even within the angling community, the outdoor rec community, that say, you know what, enough with the crisis talk, enough with the crash talk. This is just another down cycle. We don't believe that severe action is necessary. This will right itself on its own. It's cyclical. It's nothing to worry about.
I'd say first and foremost, empirical evidence from your renowned experts doesn't lie. You got to let the data speak for itself. And I would hope that every listener on this podcast would go on the Save Wild Trout website and pull up the hyperlink to the actual FWP data and look at it for yourself. This is not hyperbolic statements to say that when you have a population that has historically been at, let's just use the surrogate of 2,000 fish per mile, and you're down to 800 or even 500, 400, you're at the 25th percentile, right? It's simple math. And we also know empirically, based on national data sets, when you have populations that low, you're lowering the ability of to have recruitment from your spawners. Add into that, again, the frankenfish, the diseased fish that is affecting your spawners. It's going to go downhill. So when people talk about this idea of the ship will right itself, I think that they're discounting heavily the idea that, number one, we are empirically at a very, very cautionary tale right now where we're at with numbers and the science and the fishery populations. And I think they're also discounting the wild card right now, which is we have, in fact, a big change in climate. You know, we are losing snowpacks much earlier in the year in Montana. It's no secret that you can have a banner snowpack, but if it all runs off and it's not there come August, oh boy, that's bad news bears for the fish, but it's also bad news bears for all the other users. So I would argue, and I would also heavily encourage everybody, let's agree to disagree in terms of potentially what the management solutions would be, but let's not all try to come together and agree that when your expert scientists are showing you what the data is saying, that we're at tipping points, let's agree to that, and then let's try to figure out what that best path forward is that's going to give us bang for our buck across all sectors.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I know that you guys are off to a great start as far as fundraising for your near future goals with Save Wild Trout. I know that we're proud and energized to support the efforts of Save Wild Trout. And as such, I have a check here for you guys for $10,000 from the Yellow Dog Community and Conservation Foundation. We hope it will help with the overall goal of raising $500,000, which I think you guys have put out as your immediate near future goal. I also know that Yeti, Patagonia, Orvis, and a huge number of the regional shops, the fly shops, the fishing lodges, outfitters, they've also stepped up in a big way. And that does mean that things are off to a good start. People are paying attention, which is great. But all of that said, Save Wild Trout still needs funding. It needs to happen in the near future. Tell us, how can individual anglers, listeners today, people who are involved maybe with a family foundation, with a company that supports outdoor and conservation initiatives, people who care deeply about the fate of Montana's wild trout resources, how can people help with this campaign? What can people do to get involved?
I think first on the angling side, and then I'll kick it back to Guy for the budget building side. But we as anglers can all take a pledge, which is listed on the SaveWildTrout.org website, which is pinch your barb, get up early and fish the cool part of the day. Don't keep fish out of water long. Get out of the boat if you're in a boat. If you're going to take a photo, wait till the cameraman or woman is ready. Lift and then drop. And it sounds super easy, and rarely do we see it happen. You see the the guide or the angler reach out with a long-handled net, flip the fish up in the boat, set it down in the floor of the boat, row over to the bank, drop the anchor. The fish has flopped its head around on the floor. Even a healthy, good-conditioned fish in cold water is probably not going to survive that. So when we're down to these critical lows, let's all come together and redefine a successful day on the river. When you catch that fish, savor it a little longer, talk about it, sit there and enjoy where you are, rather than just rah, 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 let's go get 20 more of those. And the ones you catch, know what you're catching, know what you're involved with. This is a wild trout in a dwindling population that we need to save right now. That's what the angling community can do. And from a fundraising side, that $500,000 was our year one budget. We're getting late in the year. We were able to hire a science team lead. We need to build a team around that person. And now we're looking out toward, you know, this dissolved oxygen deprivation period through August and into September, which we're really worried about. But now looking forward into the winter and next year, we need to work on next year's budget.
Yeah, and I think to put a finer point on that, a lot of the listeners are probably people that have been very successful in different business endeavors, have worked throughout United States, and it's multi-levels of how do you create success. And let me tell you, creating success through a nonprofit is a hell of a business to run. And more importantly, what we look at is line items, right? Having a sond to put in a river. If your private family foundation wants to really help out sponsoring, I want to help you have three sonds. Each one of those sonds is $12,000 out of pocket. Management, placement, upkeep of those things runs $2,000 to $3,000 a year. So when you think about the river system and you think about scientific modeling, you need to have usually at ideal world, we're talking five sons per river system. We're talking about four rivers. You can do the math. Numbers add up real quick just in terms of getting the actual scientific equipment. And then you talk about having the right people with the right degree and specialties being able to give you good feedback in terms of what the heck the data means. And, if you come out to Montana and you come from the sea level, you're probably sucking air for the first day or two because we're a little bit higher in the air. Well, think about a fish. When you have an algae bloom or you have really high temperatures, it's doing the exact same thing to that fish. It's having a hard time breathing. Add into that the idea of having a big fish on and you're really working him hard. He's breathing hard trying to summit the mountain. Long story short, we're trying to qualify and quantify that data. Being able to qualify and quantify that data to come up with empirical studies that essentially show where do we need to protect habitat? Where are we seeing the worst conditions? We need to have experts opine on that. It needs to be nonpartisan and it needs to be up to date. You can't do that with antiquated data. And likewise, you can't just opine and bucket biology is not going to save the day here. So I would offer that help us assemble the right team, help us make sure it's the best folks out there for the job. And likewise, invest in people that are willing to think outside the box and to do so in a way that's, again, looking for durable solutions that are going to be able to provide for this legacy of what wild trout fisheries mean socially, ecologically, economically in Montana. We're trying to come up with that right game plan now, and we need your help to get there.
And by the way, when this team is in place and this becomes a successful endeavor in the Big Hole Beaverhead Jefferson Basin, this is copy-paste up to the Flathead, which has a similar story to tell, or over to the Yellowstone. This is what Montana needs. So we build out the right team now. They're not gone in 2 years. They just move.
Yeah. And I would say to all of our listeners, savewildtrout.org. If you're going to support one entity this year, this is a good one. Montana holds such a special place in the hearts of so many anglers, whether, again, you live here or this is a place you visited when you were younger or it's a destination you come to every summer with your family. This is a good one to support, savewildtrout.org. Very easy to go and visit the website, donate, and make a difference today. Absolutely. Well, in conclusion, I want to say, it's important for our listeners to understand that right now, we kind of led in the intro with some doom and gloom and some pretty sobering numbers and some sobering data, right? I think it's certainly got everyone's attention. But it's good to know that the fishing in Southwest Montana is not closed. Most guides and outfitters continue to operate as before, albeit with some adjusted time windows, time frames, best practices, the things you were just talking about, Wade. With that in mind, how should anglers visiting the area and those that, whether they're going with a guide or staying at a lodge or DIY fishing on their own, how should they approach their trip to the Jefferson Basin Rivers, the Big Hole, the Beaverhead, the Ruby, in the coming weeks and coming months, again, as we get into the tougher part of the summer?
Well, this year, I think we're lucky in that we've had rain the last 8 days in a row. We've had cold temps. We had a cold snap. Highs in the 90s dropped to highs in the low 60s, and nights are starting to get longer. Haying is about done. As we hit our full frost, the deciduous trees will stop sucking water. They'll give back. We get a recharge of flows in September. But as you're booking trips in the future, know that you're going to be asked to do some different things. And I think lodge owners and fly shops and guides may have been hesitant in that because it sounds like a lot of work to get up that early and we have to get off the river by 2 or 3. I don't think the clientele is there. I think you guys on the other side of this speaker system are all willing to do whatever it takes to get the best fishing in. And so expect in July and August to get up early. Expect to, wade more if you can, and in the boat, get out of the boat when you catch the fish, all the things I just said. So we need to change how we handle the resource. And I think we need to temper our expectations, knowing the numbers in these rivers, knowing the increased pressure on these rivers, and knowing that they're on their knees right now. We need to redefine what a successful day on the water is.
Absolutely. Good words right there. Gentlemen, any other closing thoughts before we sign off today?
Thank you so much for having us, and thank you for this check.
Great opportunity, and likewise, really appreciate Yellow Dog's support. Means a lot, but also the opportunity to talk to the listeners across the nation. Appreciate this opportunity.
Absolutely. SaveWildTrout.org. Check it out. Get involved. Scratch a check. Make a difference. Thanks for listening. And that is it for this latest episode of Waypoints, the podcast that is 100% dedicated to travel and the search for adventure. Be sure to visit yellowdogflyfishing.com to plan and research your next fishing trip, source gear, equipment, and flies for your next destination, and stay up to date on the latest travel news and developments. Join us for our next episode of Waypoints, and remember, life is short and no one ever regretted a life of adventure.
This has been another episode of Waypoints, the podcast of fly fishing travel and adventure angling. Waypoints is produced by Brian Gregson, with music provided by the Steep Canyon Rangers. Visit yellowdogflyfishing.com for more destination profiles, travel news, and expert advice, and be sure to join us for our next episode.